I should have the exam ready by Wednesday, the results. Okay? So let's go on and finish up cardiovascular, go on to pulmonary. So two other things we want to talk about in cardiac diseases. We talked about ischemic heart disease. We talked about rheumatic heart disease, which is a hypersensory reaction type 2. We have antibodies to streptococcal antigens that cross-react to various components of your heart, causing cardiac injury. Another thing that can occur and cause damage to the heart is bacteria circulating in your bloodstream. And they can come from various sources. We call this infective endocarditis. These are clinical terms that you'll hear clinicians use, and that means acute infective endocarditis, that the bacterium that's causing this is highly virulent. In other words, it's causing a lot of acute inflammatory reaction to it, being more destructive. And it has a higher mortality rate and morbidity associated with it. The most common organism we'll talk about is Staphylococcus aureus, a very common bacterial organism. When you talk about subacute, you have less clinical features, and it tends to be a less virulent organism, and the inflammatory response to be less than compared to acute. And has a lower morbidity and mortality rate in reference to it. The common organism for this is Streptococcus viridans, which is in your syllabus and on your slides. And we'll get to that. So infective endocarditis, the risk factors. And this is where, how do we get bacteria in our blood? That's how you think of this. One is if you have an abnormal heart with an abnormal valve, like rheumatic valvular disease, bacteria, if they're swimming in your bloodstream, they're normally taken out by your spleen. And if the organism is allowed to, because of turbulence and so forth, stays in the blood because of mitral stenosis or regurgitation, it allows it to bind to it and then cause an inflammatory response, cause further damage. Another example is when you have congenital heart disease, it causes abnormal flows, where you have ventricular septal defect, for example, where the flow is going from the left to the right because of a higher pressure gradient, and it causes turbulence and can now lead to increased risk for infective endocarditis. If you have a valvular problem, mitral valve, is you notice is a constant issue on the left side because there's high pressure and turbulence, it can be a site for bacteria to bind to it. And prolapse means what? It means to go backwards into the left atrium. Think of it like a parachute being pulled back in the left atrium. It should be taut and it can be pulled and pulled, and it can stretch out and actually snap the chorda tendineae. There can be acute and chronic forms of this. Mostly it's chronic. If you have older people, when I mean older, 80, 90, 70-year-olds, that have basically calcified their aortic valve because of use over decades, we call this degenerative calcific valvular disease. Because of abnormal thickening, your normal valve is the thickness of a sheet of paper. That can increase the risk. And the most common congenital heart defect in an individual, in a human being, is a bicuspid aortic valve, because remember, the aortic valve normally has three cusps. And so now, because you've had abnormal valve, this is like your veins, valves are bicuspid, and because of the abnormal flow and high pressure, this is going to cause acceleration, degeneration, and calcification. If you have patients who have indwelling catheters, or catheters are always changed every 48 hours, 24 to 48 hours, because when you put a catheter through someone's skin, no matter where it's in the body, and it now breaks down a barrier and allows potentially bacteria to get into the bloodstream and cause line sepsis, can also go to your heart and cause infective endocarditis. Obviously, we fight off bacteria and fungi with neutrophils. So if you have less neutrophils because you have some destruction to your bone marrow, you can't make enough neutrophils, or you're immunocompromised, or your immune suppression, you're not able to fight off the infections, can also take hold. Things that when you're immunodeficient, you see fungi, like, for example, aspergillosis can go to the heart and cause extensive damage and cause a high morbidity mortality. And the obvious one is sharing needles, where now you're going to allow bacteria, and that can be obviously a bad thing and lead to increased risk for infective endocarditis. Why is this important to learn? How much does it cost society to treat one patient with infective endocarditis? Can be anywhere between $500,000 to $1.5 million per patient. And so it's important to understand the morbidity and mortality, and that's despite treatment. So if you don't treat it, it's 100% guarantee percent mortality, and it costs a lot of money because in a hospital, it costs anywhere between $3,000 to $4,000 just a hospital stay a day, and you have to treat these with IV antibiotics. That can be $2,000 or $3,000 a day. The IV antibiotics. You need a new heart valve. You got to go thoracic surgeon. You got $100,000 to $150,000. You're in a medical ICU because you're in septic shock. That's $5,000 to $6,000, $7,000 a day. You're in renal dialysis because your kidneys fail. You've got pulmonologists, cardiologists. You can imagine the hospital bill goes up. So medicine is not cheap. And so it's important to how to recognize these risk factors and to prevent them. So acute infective myocarditis, as I mentioned before, is Staphylococcus aureus, highly virulent, because it's very pus-forming. It likes to draw a lot of neutrophils. And you can have Staphylococcus aureus in bone, osteomyelitis, skin infections. So it's a very common pathogen. Many humans carry their nasal passages as a carrier of Staphylococcus aureus. So what you're going to see are these, as the bacteria bind to the surface of the valve or any part of the endocardium, it's going to cause the inflammatory cells to come in there. Fibrin will be laid down as a function of time. The bacteria are now growing, and now that you create a vegetation, which is made of these various components. And now this vegetation, because it's fibrin, we know that fibrin from clotting cascade is very friable. It can, pieces of it with bacteria can now break off as the heart is going through its kinetic motion through diastolic and systolic function, and pieces now come off. And now you become one big abscess and go through your skin, to your eyes, to your brain, to your kidneys, to other organs, bone, to kidneys. And you can imagine it becomes a real big problem to treat these patients. And again, with therapy, 35 to 50% mortality rate. This is a patient who is an IV drug user, and this happens to be the tricuspid valve, because if you look at this carefully, you can see that there's one, two, three valves. One does not have papillary muscle attached to it, septal leaflet. And here you see these green vegetations. And you can see the green wall. We know it's not normally green. And that's that myeloperoxidase we talked about, purulent exudate. And what color is it? Yellow-green. And there it is. So these are the vegetations. You can imagine those breaking off, pieces, little micro pieces going to the lung, producing abscesses, can get through from the lung and then to the left side and disseminate throughout your body as a consequence. Here's what a vegetation looks like. You can see that at the top, there is the normal valve thickness, avascular structure. This is the left ventricular wall. And the arrow is pointing, let's see, there's the arrow to the normal valve. There's the left ventricular wall. That is the chorda tendineae attached to the mitral valve. And here you see this big, large pink vegetation. And that blue material there is bacteria and PMNs. And you can't see it, but there's bacteria throughout that vegetation. And you can imagine each time that valve opens and closes, pieces come off and now disseminate throughout the body. Do you feel this? No. You'll feel the consequences of this in terms of organ failure and sepsis, the consequences of septic shock. So in fact, a subacute, this is a less virulent organism. And basically, the vegetations tend to be smaller, but can still be deadly if it's not treated. And basically, it usually occurs on abnormal or diseased valves. And the mortality rate is less compared to the acute. So you can see how definitions in medicine, you'll see in various areas of physical therapy, you'll see that there are definitions for various conditions based on empirical clinical observations. And so it's important to distinguish why the name is given that way, because it gives you an understanding of what the degree of the problem is in terms of what's occurring. So cardiac complications. Well, if you have a valve, the valve is the thickness of a sheet of paper made of elastin and collagen, and the PMNs contain what? Elastase and collagenase. So they can actually drill a hole right through your valve, and now it becomes incompetent as a consequence. Like pouring battery acid on your heart and watching it dissolve as a consequence. It may cause damage where you lead to fibrosis and scarring, making the valve thicker and less compliant and leading stenosis or regurgitation. If it's on the left side, the pieces can break off as septic emboli, come back through the coronary circulation through diastolic filling, and then lead to abscesses to the myocardium. It can go to the pericardium, produce a pericarditis. It could also go to your SA and AV node. If you get an abscess there, what's going to happen to conduction? Complete heart block and death occurs. So you can see why this is a very dangerous disease. And it can be suppurative or pussy pericarditis and cause a damage to the pericardium and fusing it with the pericardial sac and interfering with cardiac function. If you have artificial valves, any prosthesis in the human body, if you have bacteria circulating, can be a nidus for infection, and the valve around the annulus of the valve or the edge of it, the bacteria could come in and then PMNs come in, and what's the scar tissue made of? What type of collagen? One. And therefore you release that collagenase from the neutrophils and it now causes the valve to rupture and you have dehiscence as a consequence. Embolic complications, obviously we've mentioned it goes through the brain, the spleen, kidneys, eyes. You can actually see abscesses. If you did a rectal exam on somebody's eyes, you would actually see these pinpoint abscesses called Roth spots. They can be on the palms and soles of the feet as purpuric or purple lesions because the abscesses are caused within the blood vessels and the dermis, and you'll see abscesses forming and hemorrhage within the skin. They're called Oster's nodes, or tender raised abscesses, basically, with the hands and feet. The palms and soles are called J-way lesions, and they're very distinct. And they're going to be non-traumatic, and the raw spots are going to be petechial hemorrhages and white exudate within your eyes. The lungs are going to be on the right side if you have vegetation, like on your tricuspid valve or pulmonic valve. And metastatic, widespread, again, that's how you think of it conceptually. You get abscesses throughout the body. It can go to your joints. And it's more common in the acute versus the subacute. Renal complications, obviously 10 to 15% of your cardiac output goes to the kidney. So it can lead to an embolic infarcts of the kidney. And multiple abscesses go to glomeruli and produce focal glomerulonephritis. And they can involve all your glomeruli and destroy it. Then you go into uremia and acute renal failure as a consequence of this problem, and multiple abscesses everywhere. So hypertension. Any questions about infective endocarditis? All right. It's preventable. That's why people who have surgeries or if they have any type of cardiac problems, heart valves or anything, what do you think they are given?
Antibiotics.
It's cheaper to give them $50 worth of antibiotics than $1.5 million. So it's important to recognize it. Is hypertension very common in the adult population? The answer is yes. This is more common than infective endocarditis. One out of every three adults in the United States will develop hypertension in their lifetime. One out of every three. You're more guaranteed to get hypertension than win the lotto. So it's very common. Can it be prevented? Yes, depending on what the underlying problem is. So when we think of hypertension, the patient has to understand, not by numbers, this is how it's defined quantitatively, but qualitatively, hypertension is barrel kinetic energy destroying all organs in the human body. We'll show examples of this. It's a silent killer. You can't feel it. All you'll feel at the end is the end organ damage as a consequence. And this is the thing, it's like diabetes. Half the population don't know they have diabetes in the United States because you can't feel sugar going up in your bloodstream. It'll be the consequences of it. And so hypertension, like diabetes, are silent killers. So systolic, their normal blood pressure in you and I, systolic should be less than 120 and diastolic less between 80 to 60. Depends if you're exercising all the time, your heart rate and blood pressure could be lower because your heart is more efficient as a pump. That's how you think of it. What do you mean? You mean in terms of height-wise?
Yeah, like I always have pretty low because there's not a lot.
Well, you just have an efficient heart to meet the metabolic needs of your body. That's all. It's well adapted. You're good to go. Everyone is going to be different, and so you have to look at the patient. So this is what systolic pressure is, 140 or above, or a diastolic pressure, 90 and above. This is at rest. Obviously, what happens when you exercise? All blood pressures go up when you exercise. When you get stressed, what happens to your blood pressure? Goes up. So blood pressure is variable during the course of the day or even at night. You may have it be a great dream or a stressful dream, and your blood pressure will go up correspondingly, depending on what the dream is all about. Hypertension, I told you, is very common. The complications are asymptomatic. You don't feel it. And that's the key. I've done so many autopsies on patients who died of the consequences of hypertension. So it's a very common condition. No organ is spared. So when we think of the afterload, as cardiovascular plumbers, when we talked about this section, what part of the heart has to work harder now? Because it's like going in the weight room, because you increase the afterload, is the left ventricular wall. It has to pump against that higher pressure in the arterial system. So what do you get? Left ventricular hypertrophy. But what's the problem? That heart muscle is not hypertrophied. What happens to its conduction? Is it increased or decreased? Its conductivity. It's increased. Now you can lead to a lethal arrhythmia while you're asleep and you will never feel it. I've done autopsies on people who died in their sleep because of severe left ventricular hypertrophy. What happens if you have bigger hypertrophied muscle cells? What happens to oxygen nutrient demand? Goes up. So what's the most common form of cell injury that myocardium will suffer? Hypoxia, or what we call an infarct. As a consequence, you can die of a heart attack in your sleep and you won't know it. And so this is a very important disease you want to prevent. What's the most common disease that causes intracerebral hemorrhage? Is hypertension. You blot a blood vessel. Your brain is the consistency of what? Jello. So you can imagine that 30% of your cardiac output comes off the arch of the aorta. This is a place where it causes significant morbidity and mortality by having a hemorrhagic stroke. Yes? That is true. So the statement is that if you have a thicker wall, the volume, the wall chamber should get smaller. It does. So what is the heart doing to compensate for it? Is increase heart rate. So you get tachycardia. So you have a hyperdynamic heart. And then what happens to oxygen and nutrient demands? Goes up. And what's the likelihood of an arrhythmia or a heart attack occurring at any moment? Very high. Is increased, because what is the heart muscle really? A conduction system, isn't it? Because it has to depolarize and repolarize. So if you have more heart muscle, what happens to conduction? It's very hypersensitive. So what could happen is these myocardial cells could act as an ectopic pacemaker and you can have an arrhythmia at any moment. Of the myocardium. Because each of those myocardial cells is a conduction tissue, isn't it? So if they're bigger, what happens to conductivity? It increases. So what if one of those, or an area of the heart, has an abnormal repolarization or depolarization during this process? It leads to arrhythmia. Right. It's there. Well, it's going to be mostly but that myocardium, not the conduction system, is going to become hypertrophied because it has its contractility proteins. The conduction system is modified myocytes. They're smaller. They're not seeing. They're primarily conduction, but it has to go conduction through the myocardium, which is hypersensitive now because of the hypertrophy. Does that make sense? Yes.
Wait, so then just to get it straight, what would cause, because we have an exam on Thursday about this, on different reasons.
Right, there's many reasons, but if you interfere with the conduction system, one way to increase conduction or increase the likelihood of ectopic conduction is have hypertrophied heart muscle cells.
Wait, so the mechanism there, though, is that there's just more cells? So there's
no, not more. Remember, these are permanent cells. They're hypertrophied, bigger cell.
So
that increases, yes.
How does that increase the possibility that it's going to...
Because what's on the wall that you learned about in physiology in those myocardial cells are sodium, potassium, calcium channels, aren't they?
Uh-huh.
And what would happen to that? Increase. Because you have a bigger muscle mass, and therefore the likelihood of arrhythmia goes up. Yep, and that's what happens. That's why when you look at that heart, it's arrhythmogenic. It can increase the likelihood of arrhythmias because of this fact. So, hypertension. So, what are causes? They come in, most hypertension is unknown. But there are things you can do. What are things you can do to minimize hypertension in your body? Huh? Less salt. That's one, because what falls salt everywhere? Water. What's another thing you can do? Exercise. You want to fine-tune the cardiovascular system. Not exercise. You don't have to exercise every day. You could be exercising a half hour, three times a week, four times. That'd be plenty. Those are the things. And what's another thing? What body habit is going to increase the likelihood of hypertension? Obesity. Because what happens to your blood volume when you become obese? Yep. Because you have more tissue, you need more oxygen and nutrients. And so what happens, the volume goes up, but you still have the same cardiovascular system. And you got to pump that that blood to all that extra tissue that requires maintenance. So those are three important things. Minimizing salt in your diet, exercise, and the amount of tissue you have to feed is a function of time. So these are things that people can do right now to prevent it. Another thing is anxiety. What happens to your blood pressure when you get anxious? Or what do you think happens the night before a test, like Wednesday night coming up? If you were to measure your blood pressure, not through the, well, I don't know about everyone. Everyone would be interesting to do a study. How pressure be, a path exam, a farm exam, or physical therapy, whatever particular course you're in. Okay? So it's called essential, idiopathic, or primary. That's 90-95%. Benign is when it becomes 140 to 180. You can stratify hypertension by various levels. Prehypertensive is somebody between 120 and 139 systolic. That's prehypertensive. When it's hypertension, it's 140 systolic, and it goes all the way up to 179. When the systolic pressure is greater than 180, it's a medical emergency. How high I've seen it clinically? 360 systolic pressure at rest. And he came to the emergency room complaining of a headache. He was lucky he didn't blow out a blood vessel. Other people get up to 220, 210 and blow out a blood vessel. So it depends upon your structural makeup. There is no guarantee what's going to happen. So blood pressure can be accelerated and it's malignant. When it's 180 and above, it's a problem. Now your blood pressure, when you exercise, how high does it go? I'm sure you measure it. Ever measure it? Got all these devices now, Fitbit and all this stuff. You ever measure your blood pressure while you exercise? What do you think it goes up to systolically? 200? That's heart rate. I'm talking about blood pressure. When you're born, what's your heart rate? I know it's higher, but how much? Double it. When you're born, your heart rate as a baby, as an infant, is 150 to 160 beats per minute. What's a hummingbird? 1,200 beats per minute. That's pretty fast. Why the difference? What does a hummingbird and a newborn baby have in common? Why their heart rate is so high compared to your heart rate? What about wings?
They're small.
So if they're a small bird, what do you think the size of their heart is?
Small.
What do you think their stroke volume is? Small. To meet their metabolic needs, what do you think their heart rate has to be relative to their stroke volume? Quite high. So when you're born, what do you think the size of your heart is? It's just this big. So what do you think your stroke volume is? Very small. So what does your heart rate have to be? Double what it is now. So the heart pump is relative to your body mass and metabolic needs. So depending upon what it is. So your blood pressure should go up when you're exercising between 160 to 180 systolic. Otherwise, if you went higher, what would happen to you? Blow out a blood vessel. So it depends. So it's important. So malignant is a medical emergency, 180 and above. So what's an organ system that can contribute to hypertension? Is the kidney. Any disease that destroys the kidney, because what does the kidney do when its function is controlled? What atom And what molecule is sodium and water? So now if I destroy the kidney, what happens? The retention of sodium and water goes up. What happens to your blood pressure? Because of increased intravascular volume, it goes up. So anything that destroys the glomerulus can't filtrate, therefore it can lead to hypertension. If you have chronic damage to the renal pelvis because ascending infection, scarring and fibrosis, and damage to the kidney lead to hypertension. Pilo means renal pelvis, nephritis, the kidney itself. Polycystic kidney disease, this is a genetic condition or conditions that destroy the kidneys bilaterally, and it can then lead to hypertension. We'll talk about these in more detail when we get to the kidney later on. Here's one, since you're doing the cardiovascular. What if one of your renal arteries had atherosclerosis in it and decreased over a period of time the blood flow to one of the kidneys? What would that kidney do now? What would be activated if I decrease perfusion to that kidney? What would it activate? Renin and aldosterone. What does aldosterone do? How does it increase blood pressure? What three ions does it work on? Sodium, potassium, and hydrogen. So what does it do with sodium? Retains it. What do you get rid of? Potassium and hydrogen. So if you retain sodium, what follows sodium everywhere? And what happens to intravascular volume? Goes up. Now you have hypertension. So that is what happens. And then renin will be activated. Then you activate angiotensin-converting enzyme, angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, and then you get vasoconstriction, and that's going to increase what? Blood pressure. So any renal vascular disease. A disease where you deposit protein in the kidneys and destroy it, amyloidosis. If you have urinary tract obstruction, a stone or a stricture, and you prevent urine, what you're going to do is destroy the kidney through apoptosis, hydronephrosis. You go into renal failure, you're going to retain what? Sodium and water. You lead to hypertension. So one organ system you always have to think of, if it's secondary, if any disease that destroys the kidney can lead to hypertension. What's another organ system? Since you're cardiovascular plumbers and you're doing cardiovascular physiology right on Thursday, what's another way? What organ system is well known to cause hypertension you should think of clinically? Endocrine, hormones. Pheochromocytoma is a tumor of the medullary adrenal gland. What does the medulla secrete? Catecholamines. What does norepinephrine do to your heart rate and total peripheral resistance? What happens to your blood pressure? So you lead to hypertension. What's another disease? Is aldosteronism. If you have a cortical adenoma of the adrenal gland secreting aldosterone, retain sodium, get rid of potassium, hydrogen, sodium follows water, increase intravascular volume, hypertension. Another thing is Cushing syndrome, when you have issues with exogenous, endogenous cortisol, because cortisol has a mineralocorticoid effect, as you remember from physiology, and this can retain sodium and water. So prednisone, estrogen, can also have this effect. And if you have a pituitary adenoma making too much ACTH that stimulates the adrenal gland to make more mineralocorticoids and then lead to hypertension. What's another organ system that can lead to hypertension? Is the cardiovascular. So how do you do this? How do you cause the cardiovascular system to lead to hypertension? One is a congenital malformation where you get stenosis of your aorta. So if it gets narrowed proximally, around the arch of the aorta, for example, what's going to happen to the local blood pressure to your arms and head and neck is go up. So you can get what we call coarctation. If you have a vasculopathy and you cause your arteries to become inflamed, a vasculitis called pyoritis nodosa, poly meaning many arteries, and it becomes fibrotic, those walls because of the healing process, what does fibrosis do to the compliance of our arteries? Goes down. What happens to total peripheral resistance? Goes up, leading to hypertension. So vasculopathies can also lead. So remember that blood pressure formula in physiology equals what? Cardiac output times total peripheral resistance. Anything that increases one of those variables, you get hypertension. So So this is the way you think of it and how you're going to cause hypertension. What happens to your blood volume when you become pregnant? Goes up. So women get hypertension during pregnancy. What do we call it? Preeclampsia, eclampsia, HELLP syndrome. And this is where you get severe hypertension that can destroy various organs and cause fetal demise. So what's another organ system that leads to hypertension? Is your CNS. Neurogenic hypertension. Whoops, I went through that. When people have phobias, fear of anything, what do you think happens to your blood pressure? If you're a patient who's bipolar in the manic phase, what do you think happens to their blood pressure? What do you think when somebody has schizophrenia and their paranoid delusions? What happens to their blood pressure? What happens students before an exam? High blood pressure. That's why I always recommend go see a movie the night before an exam. Go relax. Go see Doctor Strange. It's a great movie. A lot of fun. It's less than 2 hours. And then, of course, study. All right? Benign hypertension, the gross, I'm going to use the kidney as an example, since 10 to 15% of your cardiac output goes to the kidney. It will cause damage over a period of time. Will the patient feel this? No. So what happens is the tissue becomes fine granular, it becomes fibrotic, and you get arteriosclerosis. And what happens is, in this case, is think of my hand as the arterial. Is it normal under low or high pressure, the arterioles? Normally, your arterioles are under physiologically under high or low pressure? Low. They better be low. By the time they get the blood from your aorta down to your arterioles, they should be low. Now you have hypertension. Think of my hands as two endothelial cells. What's going to happen is it's going to separate chronically over a period of time. What's going to leak out? Proteins. They're going to stimulate fibrosing process around the artery. If the wall of the arterial, if the wall becomes thicker, what happens to its lumen? Decreases. What happens to compliance? Decreases. And now what happens to total peripheral resistance? And so this is what happens in hypertension. Does that happen in your eyes, your skin, your brain? Yes. And so it leads to ischemic damage. And you get all these proteins and lipids getting in there. So what vegetable does this remind you of in the supermarket?
A potato.
When I look at spuds, I think of hypertensive kidneys. This is exactly what they look like. Your normal kidney is 14 centimeters in length. When these kidneys I've seen this tall after having hypertension for decades. The kidneys are only this tall versus your kidneys are this tall right now. Yep. They get destroyed because of this process of hypertension and this chronic damage to the arterioles and this chronic leaking and fibrosing process. And then what do you lead to? Scarring and atrophy as a consequence. Here we see an arterial. You can see the wall is thickened and the lumen is diminished. And here's another arterial showing you that. This is just the kidney. This could be in your eyes, your brain, your skin, your kidney, besides the kidneys, your GI tract. And so it becomes a real problem. What happens to your blood pressure physiologically as you get older? It increases. Why? Because you're using biological tissue over decades. They often become sclerotic as a function of time. That's why your systolic and diastolic pressure gradually goes up in the population from one decade to the next. Your arteries are not the same when you're 90 years old versus when you're 5, because they're biological tissues that wear out as a function of this constant pressure being exerted on it. So you want to minimize it. Now, if you have malignant hypertension, the pressure goes even higher. Now what's going to happen is the arterioles were not designed to see that type of pressure when it's really high, and they burst. They actually literally become necrotic or fibrinoid necrosis, and you'll see petechial hemorrhages. What will you start seeing in the urine of patients? Blood. In benign hypertension, you haven't caused enough barrel trauma to release the blood, but in this case, they actually burst. You can actually see it in your eyes, these petechial hemorrhages bursting because of hypertension. If you ever get a chance and somebody has an ophthalmoscope and the patient has hypertension, you get a blood pressure, you take the ophthalmoscope, and because the vessels on the surface of the retina, you'll see the artery is bold. You'll actually see the artery pressing on the vein right as it crosses over it, and we call this AV nicking. Because of the increased pressure, it'll actually prevent blood flow through that vein underneath of it. And they call this AV nicking as a sign of hypertensive disease. And you get these petechial hemorrhages or flea-bitten appearance. On light microscopy, you're going to see onion skinning or smooth muscle cell hyperplasia. The wall becomes thicker, less compliant, lumen decreased perfusion, leading to hypoxic damage. And then fibrinoid necrosis actually caused the connective tissue in the wall of the vessel to break down because of neutrophils coming in and releasing collagenase and elastase. Here's what a kidney looks like with malignant hypertension. Each one of those little red dots represents an arterial bursting. And you're just looking at the surface. So each one of those little red dots is petechial hemorrhage. You can imagine your eyes look that way, your brain, your skin.
Why wouldn't you have that instead of the shrunken potato one?
Because the question is, because the higher the pressure when it's between 140, 180 mils of mercury in terms of your muscular arteries and aorta, it's going to cause that burl trauma to cause a release of those proteins separating the endothelial cells. In this case, what happens is you cause so much burl trauma, the other cytokines are released by macrophages and the stromal cells that make up your wall, and you get hyperplasia, smooth muscle cells, and thickening, as you can see in the upper slide right there in the circle. And you can see the lumen is diminished and the compliance is decreased. And then right there, you see an arterial going to the glomerulus, and you see all those inflammatory cells coming in because you have now fibrinoid necrosis. The way you think of hypertension, if you want to go back to physics, I think of it as transmitting kinetic energy into a wall. The more, the higher the pressure, what happens to the kinetic energy in that blood that's being delivered to that tissue? If the pressure goes up, what happens to the amount of kinetic energy that's being transmitted into that wall? Goes up. This is biological tissue. Was that tissue designed to take that type of stress? No. And so you're going to accelerate the damage to the blood vessel walls as a consequence of this. And I'm just showing you, the higher the pressure, the more tissue injury. You accelerate the degenerative process. The way you think of it, Betty, pull out, you hit an artery versus a vein. You have to know your pressure, volume, compliance, and contractility. If you have those four tools, you can work through any cardiovascular plumber situation, whether it's in physiology or pathology. Any questions? All right. See, you thought you had a hard life. Look at a mosquito. If it hits an artery, what's going to happen to it? It's deadly for a mosquito. Respiratory diseases. Do a couple of introductory remarks, and then we'll take a break. The respiratory system, we're going to go over and review this. Have you gone through the respiratory physiology yet? You just started. Good. This is a preamble. I'm going to get you in the mood. The way I think of the lungs is like the cardiovascular system. There are four tools you need. Pressure, volume, contractility, and a big one that's really critical is compliance. Like the cardiovascular. Again, pressure, volume, compliance, and contractility. So when you think of the lungs, this is what your lungs look like. If this is from a 31-year-old, and you notice your lungs are what color? You're pink. If we were to take a quick look into your lungs, now if you've been smoking marijuana, it's a little black. If you've been smoking something else, you live in air pollution, it's a little black. Those macrophages taking up. And you can see that there is some black pigment even in this relatively normal lung, because if you look at it carefully, you see these sort of lines being formed. Those are lobular units, and those are macrophages with black pigment. So, but this is relatively what your lung should look like right now without the chest. And then where's the pericardial sac? The pericardial sac is right here. If we open this pericardial sac, you'd open up, and here you see vessels on the surface of the pericardial sac. So the lung. What's the lung and the skin have in common? They're both exposed to the environment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. With every breath you take, you bring the outside world in. And what's in that quality of air will dictate what will happen to your lungs. There are only four molecules that the lung wants to see to be happy and content. Oxygen, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and water. That's all it wants to see. Anything else? Watch what happens. Vaping, bongs, anybody says it's safe are absolutely false. They're not. But they say there are, but they're not. So when you think of the lung, we're going to break it down to five structures. And this helps you think of it. Because when they talk about pathophysiology, what happens, you have to think of these structures and how they're involved in this. And that's why I spend in this lecture go over the normal anatomy and histology to understand what's going to happen. So it's not like you have to memorize it, but just think about what is transpiring. We know the lungs are each located in a pleural cavity that's under negative pressure in order to maintain the physiologic state of this organ. So the first structure that's critical to the lung is the outside of the lung. And we call this the pleural surface. How thick is your pleural surface? The thickness of cellophane. But it has a lot of compliance to it. In other words, it can stretch. Because as you expand and contract the lungs during respiration, it has to be a lot of compliance to it. Any disease process that makes the compliance become less or it becomes stiffer, what's going to happen to the volume of the lung? Goes down. So if you had scarring on the pleura, if you had a tumor, doesn't matter what the process is, it's going to decrease the ability of that lung to expand. The next important structure is the alveolar sacs. What's the normal surface area of your lung? You have 1,500 square feet of surface area per lung as an adult for gas exchange to be optimal. There are diseases that involve the alveolar sacs, like pneumonias, inflammation, or the walls. Then the third component is the airways, and this involves the trachea, bronchi that have cartilage as well as the trachea, bronchioles that are muscle wall. Then you get down to the terminal bronchioles, respiratory bronchioles, they still just have smooth muscle cells, and then the alveolar ducts, and then the alveolar sacs, where gas exchange takes place. The next structure are blood vessels. Now, a very important concept. The lung is highly vascularized. Any lymphatic drainage goes into the veins, veins drain into the lung. So what does that have to, what's critical to remember is things that come from other parts of the body that travel through lymphatics into veins or veins directly, they always go to what organ? They'll pass through the right side of the heart, but they always go to where? The lungs. The opposite is also true. Anything that's created in the lungs, like cancer, bacteria due to pneumonia, can now be released to the rest of the body and travel. This is a very important concept because what do you think? Just by answering your question, what do you think is the most common cancer found in the lung? Primary cancer or metastatic cancer? If you had to take a guess based on what I just said, metastatic, you got it. And that's very important. What is a common problem with lung cancer? It spreads everywhere. Because it's what? Highly vascularized. And that becomes very important. Drugs go to the lungs. Antibodies go to the lungs. Immunocomplexes go to the lung. Cytotoxic T8 cells can go to the lungs. So you can imagine there are many diseases based on how you damage the lungs. Okay? All right. Then, the other thing about the lung, that the last thing before we go to break, is lymphatics. So the five structures is the pleura, the parenchyma, airways, arteries and veins, and I separate out the lymphatics because it's unique. And when we get back from break, we'll explain, because it's highly vascularized, you have to have what? Rich lymphatic system. And this becomes important when you interpret x-rays, for example, in various disease processes, whether it's cancer or an inflammatory or autoimmune diseases, because they go through the lymphatics and these patterns can be visualized on a x-ray as well as a high-resolution CT scan or chest x-ray type. Okay, on that note, we'll take a break, come back, continue with pulmonics. Any questions? This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.